everyone, and welcome to episode 62 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. So last week, we had the highest numbers we've ever had for listeners to the podcast, and I don't know if that's because you like peasants or you like rants, but thank you for listening, everybody. And if you are here because you like rants, you might be in for a treat, because today I'm going to talk about one of my favorite queens, and I might end up ranting. You never know. So one of my favorite medieval queens is Isabella of France. You can find information about her in a couple of books that I have on my shelf. One of them is She-Wolves, The Women Who Ruled England Before Elizabeth by Helen Castor. And that's just a fantastic book overall. I love Helen Castor's writing. That's why I had her on the podcast last year. Another book is a biography of Isabella, just called Isabella, She-Wolf of France. And that's by Alison Weir. And that one is all about Isabella, so it's got a lot more stuff in it. And both of these books are ones that I kind of looked over again before I'm talking to you today. Another source that I looked at is primary source. It's The True Chronicles of Jean Lebel. The one that I have is by Nigel Bryant. And I think that's the only one in English. So those are some of the things I looked at to kind of inform or refresh my memory of what I know about Isabella of France. Once upon a time, there was a princess of France. She was born in 1295. To her father, Philip the Fair. And if you don't know who Philip the Fair is, he is famously the guy who persecuted the Templars. So he's not named Philip the Fair because he was nice. He's named Philip the Fair because he was pretty. And so was his daughter, Isabella. So she's born in 1295. By the time she's 4 years old, she is engaged to a prince of England. That prince of England is named Edward. His father is Edward I of England, also known as Longshanks. If some of these names are starting to be familiar to you, that's because you came across a lot of these people if you watched Braveheart or if you watched Outlaw King. If you watched Braveheart, then Isabella is the person who is played by Sophie Marceau, the person who spent a night with William Wallace. In real life, that's impossible, not the least of which because Isabella was 10 years old at the time that William Wallace was executed. So if you need to kind of place them in time and space, this is during the Scottish Wars of Independence, and Isabella is, she's going to be married to Edward Longshanks' son, Edward. So remember Isabella's beautiful costumes from that movie, but otherwise put the movie mostly out of your head. Edward Longshanks, Edward I, dies July 7th, 1307, and he is succeeded by his son, Edward II, who doesn't have a cool nickname, probably because, well, he just wasn't all that cool, in my humble opinion, and in actually a lot of people's opinions. Okay, so Edward II has come to the throne. It's time for him to get married to this French princess that he's been betrothed to for ages. He marries Isabella January 25th, 1308. He's 23, Isabella is 12. And so there's a big age difference between them. The two of them are crowned together 1 month later. And at that crowning ceremony, everybody can see something that is a big problem in their marriage and something that's going to be a big problem for the whole realm. And that is the person sitting next to Edward on the day of their coronation is not Isabella. The arms that are placed all around are not Isabella's. They are the arms of Piers Gaveston, who is just kind of a regular dude. Edward has known him since he's about 16. And the two of them are tight. To put it mildly, they are, well, Edward is basically obsessed with Piers Gaveston, can't get enough of him, to the point at which, at her own coronation, his queen is sidelined. And this is something that everybody notices at the time, including her. Isabella has been raised as a princess. She knows her place, and her place is as Queen of England. This is not cool. Even her brothers, who have arrived to escort her there for the wedding and see her crowned, they notice this insult. I mean, Edward's even given away the wedding presents from her family to Piers. This is not cool. They bring this back, this information back to her father, who is very displeased. From the second that Edward's father has died, he started to put lands and titles, bestow all of these riches and prestige on Piers Gaveston. It becomes a big problem. And very soon after their wedding, only months after their wedding, Edward's lords and Philip the Fair of France are all pushing for Piers Gaveston to be exiled from England because Edward can't focus on anything while Piers is in the room. Reluctantly, very reluctantly, Edward does exile Piers Gaveston. But something that will become a theme as we go on, Piers almost immediately comes back. Over the next couple years, Piers Gaveston is exiled, he comes back, he's exiled, he comes back, until finally, the last time he's exiled is November 1311, and immediately, Edward II goes north to get away from his lords and kind of sticks his tongue out at them and says, that's illegal, Piers is back, and he gets all of his titles, and this is how I want things to be. Isabella, knowing that her place is next to her husband, goes up to meet him at York, and she soon becomes pregnant. Now, there is nothing scandalous about this. Helen Castor does mention that she figures that this is probably a political pregnancy. I think she's definitely on the right track with this because Isabella is now 16. For the last 4 years, she has not become pregnant by her husband. This could be, and Helen mentions this as well, it could be because he's respecting her age, didn't want to get her pregnant when she was young. Even though a lot of times nobles got married as children, they didn't consummate their relationships until later in many cases because it was safer and more respectful. So it's possible that Edward was being respectful, but it's also possible that he just wasn't all that interested in Isabella until the point at which he could really use an heir to kind of shore up his reign. Either way, Isabella becomes pregnant in early 1312. The two of them are in the north. They are avoiding the earls, and Isabella kind of gets out of town. She gets to Tynemouth Priory in spring of 1312. All of a sudden, Edward shows up with Piers, and they say, the earls are here, we got to get out of here. And then they immediately leave on a boat, and Isabella's left behind. Helen charitably says that this is because it would be dangerous to put the pregnant queen on a boat at this time. I think that perhaps Edward didn't care all that much how Isabella got out of this, as long as Piers got out of it. But maybe I'm being uncharitable. Either way, Edward II and Piers escape down the coast to Scarborough, and Isabella escapes on the road to York. Edward does meet up with her there, so, you know, maybe I'm being uncharitable. But he leaves Piers Gaveston behind in Scarborough Castle, and this is a fatal mistake that is going to have repercussions over the next decade. Piers Gaveston, he's left in Scarborough Castle, he's supposedly safe, but everybody in the kingdom hates him for being Edward's pet and also for being generally a jerk. So he is captured pretty quickly by the earls of the kingdom. Now, even though they are nobility, they know that Piers Gaveston is the king's favorite. It might not be wise to do anything rash with him, at least not before you've covered your behind. So what they do is they make promises to each other saying, I'll protect you, you know, if this comes down on you. And then they all hide behind a relative of the king's, Thomas of Lancaster. And they basically make him do the dirty work because he is the most powerful guy in the kingdom after the king and Piers Gaveston. So they all hide behind him, and it's Lancaster who takes Piers Gaveston onto his land and has him beheaded. And I think all the nobility and probably a lot of other people breathe a sigh of relief to have Piers Gaveston removed from the scene. But Edward II is furious. He is grieving. Piers is probably his lover, even though his lover was excommunicated for coming back when he was exiled. Edward takes care of his body, wraps him in cloth of gold, and waits for a moment when he can be buried as a Christian. But crucially, this happens in June 1312, and Edward never forgives and he never forgets. This is like kind of a phrase that people use in movies all the time, but it's true. He never forgives, he never forgets, and this is going to have huge repercussions. Later in that year, remember, Isabella is pregnant. In November, she gives birth to a boy, and the kingdom rejoices because not only does this shore up Edward's reign, but it means it will continue. And so Edward is happy, Isabella is happy, the entire kingdom is happy. They have a baby boy, they name him Edward, of course. The years start to pass, and there are a couple little stories in the middle which I think give you kind of a clue into Isabella's personality. The first one is she goes over to France to see her brothers get knighted. She's close to her brothers, close to her dad, and she goes and sees them get knighted. And while they're there, Philip the Fair and Edward II take vows to be crusaders. But when it comes Isabella's time to take a vow to be a crusader, she oversleeps. Oh, darn, she oversleeps. Oh, did I miss it? Was that today? So she misses the appointment to take her crusader vow. She actually does take her vow a couple days later. And as Helen Castor mentions, she does it in Isabella's style, where she vows to become a crusader, but only if her husband does, because she knows he's not a big military guy. And she only says she will donate as much to the crusader cause as she thinks is necessary, which is not going to be very much, I think, because Isabella, she likes to ride in style. So she's taken her crusader vow, but on her own terms, which is very Isabella. Then in February of 1314, she's back in France again to discuss Gascony. And maybe this is the moment at which I should tell you about Gascony. Gascony is a duchy in France that belonged to the English, but it was really under the control of the King of France. So the English had control of Gascony, but only as feudal underlings, if we want to use that phrase, to the King of France. So even though Gascony is ruled by the English, it belongs to the French technically. So when Isabella's over in Paris, February of 1314, she's there to discuss business. She's there to discuss Gascony with her family. But while she's there, and this is a coincidence, or maybe it's not a coincidence, you decide. While she's there, it's discovered that her three sisters-in-law have been making trouble. Two of her sisters-in-law have been having affairs with knights, which is a really dangerous thing to do and really not what you can do when you're married to princes of France. It's treason. And the third sister-in-law was helping to make it happen. So all three of Isabella's sisters-in-law are imprisoned in Chateau Gaillard. So they are removed from the scene. They are removed from court. They are banished to Chateau Gaillard, where their heads are shaved and they are disgraced. Their lovers are executed in an extremely painful way to make an example of them. These women lose everything. And you can decide or not whether Isabella had something to do with that. There's rumors that she did. She might have and she might not have. She might have had nothing to do with it. But Isabella was always very concerned with royal dignity, so I wouldn't put it past her if she discovered this, that she would do something about it, because she was very much about royal dignity. Now, we want to remember this incident later, but this might have been something that was kind of a key to Isabella's personality. So she comes back from France, where all of this drama has happened. She immediately heads to the north of England. She's there to support her husband because her husband is finally going to hammer the Scots into submission, just like his father did. So it's June 1314, and if you are remembering your Braveheart, you will remember this is the Battle of Bannockburn, and things do not go well for the English here. They lose horribly. They're obliterated. And the Privy Seal of England is taken. It's just a disaster. Disaster kind of keeps following along in that later in that year, in November, Isabella loses her father, Philip the Fair dies. And this may or may not, depending on how much you love conspiracies, this may or may not have something to do with the last curse of Jacques de Molay, the guy who was the Grand Master of the Templars, who, as he was burning to death, apparently shouted out that Philip would be dead within the year. And he was. So Isabella has lost her father. Scotland's gone terribly. 1314 was not the best year for Isabella. Over the years, Edward II continues to try and win Scotland. In another adventure in June of 1319, Isabella's back up at York. Her husband's trying to fight off the Scots in the north of England, and sure enough, she has to flee again to Nottingham because the Black Douglas is coming after her. So it's another, you know, near escape for Isabella. She has to escape. This time, the Black Douglas is a few crazy years. So Philip the Fair dies in 1314. His oldest son, Louis, succeeds him. But Louis does not live very long. He only lives a couple years, and he only leaves behind daughters. And remember that Louis's wife is one of the people who has been having an affair, so it's possible that not only is his daughter, well, it's, his daughter's a girl, but not only that, she is possibly a bastard as well. So the crown can't come to her. It goes to the next son in line, who's Philippe. So I mentioned Gascony earlier. Whenever there's a new king of France, the king of England was meant to go over and pay homage for Gascony. And so Philip starts to ask, hey, Edward, when are you going to come over and pay homage to me for Gascony? That is your job as my subject. It's a complicated thing for French and English. It gets more complicated as time goes on. So Edward heads over to pay homage for Gascony, and on the way, he starts to kindle a relationship with another guy named Hugh Despenser. And even though things have been going really well with Isabella over the last few years, things have been going okay. You know, he's not winning in Scotland, but he's not losing a lot of friends either. Things are all right. But with Hugh Despenser, disaster strikes again. Now, I don't want to be one of these people who pins down Edward II's sexuality. It's probable that he was in a sexual relationship with Piers Gaveston and with Hugh Despenser, but he also had a bastard son before he was married, and he also sired children with Isabella. So a lot of people will pigeonhole him as Edward was gay. I don't want to do that. We do know that he had children with women. We know that he probably had these sexual relationships with men, so you can make of that as you will. I don't want to label him. Either way, his relationship with Hugh Despenser, just like his relationship with Piers Gaveston, is disastrous. And so Hugh Despenser, immediately as he becomes a favorite of the king, starts to take and take and take and take money, titles, whatever he can get. Helen Castor mentions that she believes Piers Gaveston was just kind of somebody who was out for himself. He just wanted to make himself grand and have a good time. And I think she's right about this. Hugh Despenser was more dangerous in that he was in it for power. So everybody's seeing the writing on the wall here. They remember Piers Gaveston and they're watching this closely. Edward makes a huge mistake when he disinherits a marcher lord. Now, if you know anything about English history, you know you never anger the marcher lords. These are the people who are in charge of the borderlands between England and Wales. They are always fighting off the Welsh. You don't make them angry because they're tough guys. They've been fighting off the Welsh so much. They have no patience for English kings who try and take their stuff. So Edward makes a huge mistake when under the influence of Hugh Despenser, he disinherits marcher lord and things start to go south. The marcher lords start to rebel against Edward, and of course what they ask for is the exile of Hugh Despenser. And so Isabella, she does what queens do. She gets down on her knees and she asks Edward to do this for the good of the kingdom, and he does. He exiles Hugh Despenser, but as with Piers Gaveston, Hugh Despenser is back almost right away. So the earls are still not very happy with Edward. They continue to be in rebellion with him. He manages to use Isabella as kind of an excuse to get more backing from loyal citizens, because Isabella has tried to, well, she's Isabella. She's kind of tried to bully her way into Leeds Castle, and she got shot at by some of the people who were in league with the marcher lords. And so, you know, Edward's saying, this is treason. And for once, he has the upper hand and he wins against the marcher lords. One of the people he imprisons is Roger Mortimer, who we're going to hear more about later. He sends Mortimer to the Tower. When Edward subdues the marcher lords, one of the people he takes into custody is Thomas of Lancaster. Now, you remember that Thomas of Lancaster was directly responsible for the beheading of Piers Gaveston. And maybe turnabout is fair play. I don't know. Edward certainly thought so, because he executes Thomas of Lancaster. And this is a big deal. As Helen Castor says in her book, this is the first time since the Norman Conquest that a lord has been executed as a traitor. So this is a very big deal. This might be the moment where things kind of go south to the point that it cannot come back for Edward II. But for him, it's a very cathartic moment because he's getting revenge on probably his greatest enemy for killing his lover. After that, it's kind of business as usual in that Edward goes up after the Scots. Again, the Scots are a constant headache for the English because they want their independence and they will raid and raid and raid and raid until they get it. And that's what's happening. So again, Edward goes up. He's trying to deal with the Scots. Again, Isabella goes up. She goes to Tynemouth Priory. I don't know why she does it, but she does. I think like this is the moment when the audience is watching the movie saying, don't go back there, but she does. So she's there in Tynemouth Priory and the Scots are closing in and she needs help. She can't get out. And so Edward's like, well, I'll just send some of Hugh Despenser's men. But remember that Hugh Despenser is a grasping guy and all he wants is Edward all to himself. Isabella knows she cannot trust Hugh Despenser. And so she actually sits there surrounded by the Scots and refuses the help of Hugh Despenser's men. Instead, she has to escape by boat, and she loses a couple of friends along the way. One is drowned, one goes into premature labor, and they both die. And so Isabella is extremely displeased with her husband and Hugh Despenser, but she knows enough that she cannot actually do anything at this point. She's a very smart woman. She's biding her time. In the meantime, meanwhile in France, I should probably just have a clip and just keep playing that one again. Meanwhile in France, Isabella has lost another brother. Philippe has died. He hasn't left any sons behind. The crown passes to her last brother, Charles. And so, of course, Charles asks for a homage to be paid to him for Gascony. But Edward can't leave England. He knows what happened when he left Piers Gaveston alone for a minute. The earls took their revenge and he doesn't want to make that mistake again. So he's delaying and delaying and delaying, and he won't go and pay homage to Charles. So, of course, Charles starts to build up an army, starts to send it into Gascony. Well, at this point, Hugh Despenser says the French are our enemies, and he takes this moment to try and take down his rival, Isabella. What he does is, because he says the French are all enemies, he takes her lands, he takes her money, he takes her household, it's mostly French and the French are enemies, takes them into custody, and he takes her children. Her oldest child, Edward, has his own household, but he takes her other children, John, Eleanor, and Joan, and he takes them and brings them to his wife to be taken care of. Now, if Isabella wasn't already angry enough at him, this does it. Isabella has done her best to be a good queen. She has supported her husband. She hasn't really been vocal about her hatred for Hugh Despenser very much, but this is basically the last straw. In the meantime, Roger Mortimer, remember him, he has escaped from the Tower of London. He's one of the very few people who managed to do that. He drugged his guards. He drugged their wine, apparently. He climbed up a chimney and then he climbed down a rope ladder and escaped on the Thames to France and then further abroad. So this is something that's kind of happened in the meantime. Charles is still putting pressure on Edward to come over and to pay homage. And again, Edward is stuck. He can't go anywhere. If he leaves Hugh Despenser in England, he's sure that he'll be killed, just probably true. If he brings him with him, the French will be hostile to Hugh Despenser because of the way that Edward has treated Isabella. And so he has nothing he can do. And in a moment of absolute insanity or desperation, whatever you want to call it, he turns to Isabella and says, you go to France and make peace with your brother. I'm sure this will work out fine. And so Isabella, I mean, I'd like to be a fly on the wall at this moment. Isabella says, okay, I'll go to France. Sure, I'll take care of it. And she does. In March of 1325, she goes to France and she stays there. And she negotiates well with Charles. She says Edward will come over and pay homage in August. But time goes on, and Isabella does not come home. Edward starts to think this is a little bit strange, but he still is stuck. And August comes along and Charles says, are you showing up or what? And Edward's still stuck. He can't bring Hugh and he can't leave Hugh behind. So Charles says, why don't you send Edward, your son, over, Prince Edward? He can pay homage to me and I will accept it. And so Edward says, sure, it's a great solution. And he sends his son, Edward the Prince, over to France. You know, I don't think that Edward II played a lot of games of strategy, as we will see, because what happens next just absolutely floored him. So he sends an envoy to France with Prince Edward. And the envoy says, in front of the French court, Isabella, you need to come home to your husband. And Isabella takes this moment, and people tend to call this kind of thing a master stroke, and this is what it is. She stands up in front of the French court and says, I believe that a marriage is between a man and a woman, and there is someone else in my marriage right now, and I'm not going back to England until he's removed. So I will be a widow, I will wear widow's clothes, I will act like a widow, but I'm not returning to my marriage until this guy is taken out. And so Edward II, he hears about this and his jaw drops and he says, you know, this can't possibly have been her idea. It must have been somebody else's idea. I can't believe it. So here's Isabella in France. She's got the heir to the throne and she's kind of on the side of the angels here in pretty much everybody's eyes. Edward II writes to Charles and says, send my wife home. And Charles says, sorry, dude, she's my sister. I'm going to support her as long as she wants to stay. So all of the people who have been angered by Hugh Despenser and sent to the continent in exile or they've escaped, all of those people start to flock to Isabella. One of them is Roger Mortimer. And this is one of those moments where the two of them, they'd been on opposite sides before, and now they find themselves on the same side and they immediately fall for each other. Now, I mean, I think that people look back on history and they match people up and they say their love matches, and maybe that's kind of wishful thinking, but I think for these two, it was combustible. And both of them kind of push each other in ways that they never did before and they never did afterwards, as we'll see. So the two of them, it's kind of like a Macbeth, Lady Macbeth relationship. They are each other's catalysts for whatever is to happen next. What happens next? So Isabella, wisely, very, very smart woman, restarts negotiations with Hainault. She had already considered marrying Edward, her son, to one of the girls from Hainault. She negotiates this marriage, and instead of bringing dowry with her, Philippa of Hainault brings soldiers. And so she, Philippa of Hainault, is betrothed to Edward the Prince. And through this betrothal, Isabella gains an army. She also gathers together mercenaries. And this is kind of one of those other things that you often see in the Middle Ages. Nobility, perhaps they don't support each other, even though they're relatives. In this case, Isabella gathers mercenaries. She says she will pay them. And she's backed by Charles. So if she can't pay them, her brother, the King of France, will pay these mercenaries. So Isabella has gathered an army. She sails across to England. September 24th, 1326, she arrives in England and she's welcomed. Everybody starts to lend support to her. She seems like she's the person who has been wronged in this case. The heir to the throne seems like a much better option than the current king. And Edward and Hugh are on the run. So as Isabella and Roger Mortimer are starting to cross the country, they are not acting like they're together, but they're pretty much together. They are pursuing Edward and Hugh Despenser across the country. Edward and Hugh eventually get to the coast, the west coast. They try and get on a boat, and the Irish Sea does not cooperate with them. And after about 6 days of getting blown back into the harbor, they land again on the coast of Wales and try to escape. They do not. They are taken into custody. Hugh Despenser, of course, is executed. His execution follows the manner of William Wallace's execution in that it was meant to be the worst possible death because he was the worst possible traitor. So Hugh Despenser was hung, he was castrated, he was disemboweled, and then he was beheaded and quartered, the four quarters of his body sent to different towns. It was shocking. It was meant to be shocking. It was not a normal execution. And it's actually been illustrated by a medieval person. It's one of the most famous medieval manuscript pictures you can find. So if you do want to Google Hugh Despenser's execution, you can do that. Edward II, of course, is taken into custody. He's treated fairly well as far as we know, but he is constantly a problem because people keep trying to break him out. It happens 3 times that people try to break him out, and shortly after the 3rd time, Edward dies mysteriously. There are later rumors, and they do come around later, that Edward had hot poker shoved up him. The likelihood that this happened is pretty much zero. It's just a story that medieval people would have found poetic justice in their worldview, given the relationships that Edward had with Piers Gaveston and Hugh de Spencer. The medieval worldview on that kind of relationship was dismal, and so this would have been seen as kind of a fitting torturous punishment. It probably didn't happen at all. There were immediately rumors that Edward had escaped, that he was living on the continent, that he became a hermit. This is explored in a few books. I think Ian Mortimer's book, Alison Weir gets into it in her book as well. And they both kind of lend some credence to this. I think that Edward did die in captivity, that it wasn't a death that was particularly dramatic. He was killed in a way that doesn't seem to have left a mark on his body. So Alison Weir says, and I would agree with her, that the manner of death is probably something like suffocation. Alison Weir does talk about how Isabella met with Edward's embalmer afterwards. If she met with Edward's embalmer afterwards, that would probably imply that Isabella didn't have anything to do with the murder and wanted to know. See, I say murder. I think Edward was probably murdered. That Isabella probably didn't have anything to do with it and wanted to know what the state of the body was. It's possible that Isabella ordered it. It's possible that Mortimer ordered it. It's possible that she knew. It's possible she didn't know. And so we don't know what Isabella's involvement was in the murder of her husband. And I do think it's safe to say he was murdered. We don't know what her involvement was. It could have gone either way. I think it's equally likely to have gone either way. But when Edward II was killed or died, however it happened, his heart was sent to her in a little silver casket or vase. We will come back to that later. Edward II is now dead. The power behind the throne, I mean, the person who's on the throne right now is Edward III. He's married, but he is still young, and the power behind his throne is his mother, Isabella, and her lover, Roger Mortimer. And the two of them, I think, especially Isabella's, had such a rough time being married to Edward and not given respect for so long that she takes way too much. She takes way too much and she takes it way too fast. And she doesn't stop Roger Mortimer from doing the same thing. And so the two of them make a lot of the same mistakes that Edward II did, ironically, where they take too much money and they take too much power. In the meantime, what perhaps was the turning point was in 1328, Isabella negotiates a treaty with Scotland. And the treaty basically gives the Scots everything they ever wanted. They are said to be independent. Robert the Bruce is acknowledged as their king. And Edward III, this treaty is made in his name, but he vocally opposes it. He says he really does not agree to it in any way. Part of the negotiation is that his youngest sister, Joan, is given marriage to Robert the Bruce's son, David. And Edward refuses to attend the wedding in Scotland. He is just not having it. And so Edward is starting to push against the rule of his mother and Roger Mortimer. Alison Weir mentions in her book that it's possible that on a couple occasions, Isabella might have fallen pregnant with one of Roger Mortimer's children. She figures it might have been two, in that Isabella is known to have changed her will a couple times. And the only time she did that beforehand is when she was pregnant with Edward. So it's possible that Isabella became pregnant. It doesn't seem that she had any children from Mortimer. But one person who did become pregnant definitely was Philippa of Hainault. She ended up giving birth to Edward, another Edward, who is known to history as the Black Prince. And when this happened, Edward kind of takes a lesson from his mother, where he has waited, he's bided his time, he's dealt with his enemies, and now he has his son as sort of an insurance policy. And this is when he makes his move. He's tired of Mortimer more than anything else. He's more forgiving of his mother. But he takes his chance when he's at Nottingham Castle with his mother, Isabella, and Mortimer. And in the dead of night, Edward allows his friends to come through a tunnel, which I think is still called Mortimer's Hole, come through a tunnel and capture Mortimer and Isabella. And Isabella, of course, is screaming like, please, please take care of Mortimer. Don't hurt him. But of course, I think everybody knows at this moment that Mortimer is not long for this world. So Mortimer is taken to the tower again, but this time he does not escape. Isabella is taken to another castle where she's held on, basically under house arrest. She cannot come close to London. She cannot influence anything. She is held carefully, but she is definitely held under house arrest. Roger Mortimer is charged with all sorts of treasonous things, including the murder of Edward II. He is convicted as a traitor, and he is sentenced to the same death that Hugh Despenser was. But I think this kind of speaks to Edward III's relationship with his mother. He makes it so that Roger Mortimer doesn't suffer as much as Hugh Despenser did. Instead of being disemboweled, castrated, beheaded, Roger Mortimer is hung instead. So this is sort of a mercy. Medieval hangings were not about snapping the neck, they were about strangulation. So this wasn't actually super merciful. Beheading would have been a lot quicker. But as Helen Castor mentions in her book, this is the same punishment that a thief would have. And I think for Edward, this is the perfect punishment for Roger Mortimer. Somebody who really wanted to be the highest in the land has the same death as a common criminal. In the aftermath of Roger Mortimer's death, everything is blamed on him. I think that the kingdom knew that Isabella was complicit in pretty much everything that Mortimer did, but she is not blamed for anything, at least officially. The official line was that Mortimer was a bad influence. He is the whole reason that Isabella did anything that could possibly be seen as a bad thing. For her part, she went along with this. She never fought against it. She never spoke up for him. She was wise enough to let that go. Even though I believe that she did love him, she was probably deeply grieving him, but she did not defend him in public. She was too wise to do that. And never again did she cause any trouble. So this is what I was saying, when it feels like a Macbeth, Lady Macbeth relationship, Mortimer was a bit of trouble beforehand, but not to the point that he was when they were together. Same with Isabella, she took her destiny in hand for sure, but she wasn't as grasping as she was when she was with him, and she never was afterwards as well. I mean, she was still somebody who loved her luxury and wanted it. But she behaved herself very well after that, and she was respected. Her son still loved her, asked her advice, came to visit her. She was very close with the Black Prince, who she left a lot of her possessions to when she died. And she was very close to her daughter, Joan, who ended up coming back and living with her when David, her husband, was way too into mistresses instead. Isabella died at the age of 63. Which is a very old age for somebody in the Middle Ages. She lived through the Black Death. She lived through the beginning of the Hundred Years' War, which was fought in her name, because when her last brother Charles died, it meant that her son was the closest male in line for the throne, which really made the French upset, the idea that an English person would be in charge. But anyway, it was because of Isabella's bloodline that that happened. But in her later years, she became a member of the Franciscan order, a lay member of it. Of course, she didn't want to give up her wealth or her style of living. This is Isabella, after all. But she started to meet her death in a way that was more humble, perhaps, than she had been in the past. When she was buried at Greyfriars. She wasn't buried at Westminster. And she asked to be buried in her Franciscan habit. So very simple dress. and she asked to be married in the cloak that she'd worn when she was married to Edward all those years ago. And she asked that when she was buried, she didn't ask to be buried near Mortimer. She asked to be buried with Edward's heart in its silver casket placed on her heart. And it seems that that's how she was buried. She was buried in a Franciscan habit with her wedding mantle around her and Edward's heart placed on hers. This might seem hugely hypocritical, but this is decades after, and she had probably made her peace with her actions, and she probably made her peace with his actions, and she had found a way to kind of reconcile that. So I don't think it's hypocritical necessarily that she buried herself with her former husband's heart. So Isabella had a hugely interesting life. I think, you know, Princess of France, and she's married young, and she has all these narrow escapes by land and by sea, and she's supported by her French family, and, you know, she comes across as a conquering queen. It's just like it is. I don't know why people are not making movies about her. I think she's so interesting. I'm not sure that I'd want to, you know, necessarily be related to her. She's such an interesting figure, and I think she flies in the face of the idea that we have of medieval women being, you know, submissive. She was a very supportive queen for as long as she could take it, until she was pushed right to the limits and lost her friends, lost her holdings, lost her children. And at that point, she took things into her own hands. And when she'd established her family on the throne, she'd established Edward III, she stopped fighting. She had the respect she wanted, she had the station she wanted, and she lived with that and supported her son just as she was meant to do. So she's kind of one of these figures who is really interesting, has a lot of agency, and still plays the role that she's meant to, which I think kind of shows that the role of queens was a very complex role, and it allowed for all sorts of interesting happenings. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's going on, Peter?
Hey, how are things?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I am doing very good because I've been able to bring in 4 new writers. That's going to start in May and June for medievalist.net, writing columns on peasants, Eastern Europe, and China in the Middle Ages.
That is super exciting. That's really awesome. So we're going to get to see more of this stuff as time goes on?
Yep. As the pieces come along, I'll introduce them a little bit more, these historians. And yeah, I'm very excited. They have some great ideas for some really kind of fun stuff.
That's awesome. Is there anything else that's up on the website we should check out?
Yeah, this week you can read about the Norman conquest in southern Italy and Sicily, the Northern Lights in Iceland, Sir Lancelot in Poland, and a piece looking at the Norse myths about the creation of Norway, which unsurprisingly involves gods of snow.
That sounds about right. That's awesome. It sounds like a big spread. That's really cool.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun stuff this week.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, Peter.
Thanks.
Thank you to all of our listeners, old and new, who are tuning in weekly or binging or sending lovely messages. It's so nice to feel supported and to know that you're enjoying each episode. Thank you especially to our patrons on patreon.com who generously keep this podcast going. Patrons get all sorts of cool stuff like subscriptions to the Medieval Magazine and Medieval Warfare Magazine, and they even get books from our book club. Every little bit of patronage counts and every cent is very much appreciated. Check us out at patreon.com/medievalists. For all the coolest medieval queens and just about anything else you can ask for, follow medievalists.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can find me, Danielle Sapolsky, on social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5 Minute Medievalist. And you can find my books, including Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fiction, and The 5 Minute Medievalist, on Amazon or through your local bookstore. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening. Have yourself an amazing day.